Oh my goodness gracious, that's a wrong show. God. What even was that?
That caused the actual panic. I was like, I read the script.
We got this one. Holy cow. All right, this is the right music. Daniel Ramirez on the job. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. We are back with Make Me Smart. This is the daily version of the extended version that we do on Tuesdays, and it being Wednesday, guess what that means, Molly Wood?
What do you want to know Wednesday?
There you
go. It is the episode where we take your questions. Thank you for sending in so many of them. We are going to basically, like we do on Wednesdays, lightning round through as many as we can because we don't have a lot of time left in us, I mean.
All right.
We will get right to it with our first question, which comes from Vince Brown. Now that we are all into the blur, I like this, the blur of COVID, the economy has shrunk and jobless claims are at an all-time high. Vince says, I'm lucky enough to still be working, but looking ahead, it seems as if another contraction of the economy is merely weeks away. What are the key factors that we can look at to see if things are stable or if the economy will shrink again?
Jobs. Sorry.
I was going to say, I like jobs. How Vince thinks we know stuff about what will happen in the future.
No, we don't. But the way to find out what's going to happen in the future is to look at the jobs market. Jobsy. Four-letter word, job. That's really the thing, right? Because if ain't nobody working, ain't nobody has money, ain't nobody going to spend money, and then businesses and yada, yada. That, for me,
jobs
the number one
indicator. Jobs are a ding-dong. Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. Whether companies are getting the small business loans, for example, whether they're able to bring people back on that they may have had to lay off or furlough. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I don't know if they're, honestly, Vince, like it would be too soon to put together any other key factors. So I'm going to go with Kai's thing there. Yes.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's the, and look, sorry, just to get super weedy, that number now is it used to be like a monthly number. We would get the April jobs report, the May jobs report, whatever. Now we're paying attention to the weekly first-time claims for unemployment, right? Because the volatility in that number has gone through the bleeping roof. And that's how we're going to know. That's how we're going to know.
Yeah.
Okay.
And listen, it depends on, it's not just like the stimulus, it's not the loans. It depends on whether people are going out.
Sure.
Right? Like whether people, you can open anything you want, but if nobody comes, you're effectively closed. And so I think that people's mobility and willingness to engage in the outside world, so to speak, will also be a big part of whether the jobs can stay.
For sure. Good question, though, Vince. Thanks. Another one has to do with also jobs. It's about unemployment numbers, specifically how they're going to be counted here in this coronavirus economy. Here's Robin Brandt.
Hi, guys. I have a question regarding the horrific unemployment numbers. How are we recording workers who theoretically will be called back to work in the event of reopening? I'm confused because there's always a discrepancy between all people who are not working and those actively looking for work. And in this situation, if someone reasonably thinks their employer will call them back, they're probably not looking for another job. So where do they fit into the survey? The numbers are awful no matter how you look at them, but I'm still curious about this distinction. Thanks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is going to report, so this is Wednesday, it's going to report Friday on the April numbers, counts people who are unemployed as unemployed. There's no like temporarily unemployed category. Here, though, is a caveat. In the various government shutdowns that we have seen, the Bureau of Labor Statistics counted furloughed workers as not being out of work. Now, furlough and layoff are two different things. But my guess is at least early on in this crisis, the BLS, which, as we know, does two surveys, right? It does the establishment survey, in which it asks companies how many people they've laid off, how many jobs they've cut, and the household survey, which asks people whether or not they're actively looking for work. You get numbers of jobs cut from the unemployment survey, the establishment survey, and you get the unemployment rate from the household survey. My guess is that at least early on, out of work means out of work, because we don't know about the duration of this crisis. We truly, truly don't. And until, as Molly said in the first answer, people start going to restaurants and buying plane tickets and you know, getting their cars fixed, we're just not going to know. That's what I got.
Is what will happen, this came up on the afternoon show today, on your show.
Mm-hmm.
How many of these technicalities do you think will still be in place a couple months into this, particularly, for example, that actively looking for work thing, and what causes you to be able to qualify for unemployment?
I don't think those are technicalities, right? Those are the rules.
Well, no, and those are the rules, exactly.
Right. So if you're going to have valid data over time, yeah, they are, because you got to have valid data over time. And in 15 years, when we look back on this, we're going to want to know what it was compared to what it is in 15 years and what it was 15 years ago.
So I think I might be talking about a different rule. I think I'm saying, you going to is unemployed? Yeah, sorry, this is my fault. I'm asking, do you think that states will continue to require that people, quote unquote, look for work while receiving unemployment during a pandemic? That is a technical.
That's a
really good question. But
separate and also deeply political. Deeply political.
Yeah, good point.
Because it's going to be different in red states and blue states. It just will. As with so much else about this whole frappin' thing, which is to me insane, the politicization of a public health emergency. But anyway, that's not what we're here for. We're here for your questions. And there's no
We are. Let's keep going. The next question comes from Aaron Hansen, who, like most of us, has been spending so much time online these days. So much time. He says, when are we going to start talking about internet, the high-speed, dependable kind, being an essential service like electricity and other utilities? We live in rural eastern Washington, but not so remote that getting high-speed internet access seems like it should be a challenge. Nonetheless, it has been a fight to get the same high-speed fiber services available to others only a few miles away. I could install solar panels to get electricity if I needed it. But on the other hand, I can't really DIY a better internet connection. If my history is correct, the federal government had to mandate that electricity and telephone services be made available to rural communities almost 100 years ago. Why haven't we done the same with internet? Politics. We did. We tried. We did a little bit of that. In 2015, the Obama administration changed the rules of how the internet was classified. So actually going all the way back to 2002, the FCC, which has oversight over all things communications, classified the internet as an information service, which is different from a necessary utility, like telephone service. Mm-hmm. In 2015, with the sweeping net neutrality regulations that went into place under the Obama administration, the internet was reclassified back to a utility, much like telephone service or electricity. And then the Trump administration came in, and actually that was like pretty much the first thing they did was just switch it back to information service. And there's like a lot of argument and a lot of history about whether it is appropriate to classify the internet under what is basically like early 1900s telecommunication law. However, because it is profoundly not, it's considered this information service, which it kind of is, there's no mandate in terms of building it out. There have been over the years lots of subsidies to companies, lots, like $200 billion worth of subsidies to companies to build out access. There are various requirements that big companies license space on, you know, big internet service providers license space to smaller internet service providers. But what we really have is a lack of the kind of competition that would make it worthwhile in the eyes of these companies to build out service to extremely rural areas because it's expensive and it's really hard to get there.
Do you think, and look, this is unknowable, so spitball it for me. Do you think that this crisis, which, look, it's only been 2 months and we've already seen profound changes in the need for the internet, right? Just on an equality basis here. Do you think that changes the calculation or at least the discussion at all?
I mean, I think it should. I think it has. Like when, you know, to Aaron's question, we are definitely talking about the internet as an essential service like electricity and other utilities.
Sure.
Without a
doubt.
Sure. You and I did that interview early on, you know, back in March, I think. And there's no doubt that the digital divide is more obvious than ever right now, especially around education and the ability to work from home. It is, however, fundamentally, like so many things, a philosophical and political question. And so...
Yeah.
So the conversation will happen.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. The conversation will happen. The only answer will come when we know who's going to be in charge next year at this time.
Yeah. 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 All right. Fair enough. One last question, maybe another one if we can squeeze this one in. This one comes from Brian Mackey. He writes, I'm curious about the commercial real estate market and if the market is at risk for a 2008 level correction with an expectation that entire sectors of industry are upending, along with office space potentially under pressure from remote work. Is the bottom going to fall out of the commercial rental market? If so, what are the downstream effects for the bigger real estate markets? Well, so look, A, unknowable, right? But B, certainly within the realm of possibility. And I think it's one of those things that we're going to see how this shakes out as people start going back to work eventually. I mean, look, my wife's company is already thinking, yeah, we don't need this office space on 42nd and Lex that's costing us a boatload of money, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do a little work from homey thing. And I think that's a realistic issue. And if that happens at scale, that's a really bad thing for the commercial real estate market. That's my sense.
I know. I agree. I mean, I think if you just have to take, if you take sort of the sci-fi line, you know, if you go back to like that, this is a hinge event and it's going to change a lot of things down the road. It seems obvious to me that one of the things that's going to change is work. If a virus like this is with us for a long time and it just like inculcates the idea of living with a virus like this, then yeah, offices are going to change dramatically and people are going to say, I'm not only safer, I'm happier and more productive at home. We don't need all this space.
So two things. Number one, do you think this is a hinge event?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. Number two, have you read Station 11?
You know, no. And lots of people have brought it up, and I think I should.
It's actually really interesting. So
the district.
I looked it up after I read it because I really liked it. So first of all, it's Station 11. I don't have the author's name at the tip of my fingers, but it's a. You would think this would be a turnoff right now, but it's a post-pandemic life in America look. And it's so completely fascinating, and it's page-turner. And it's going to be made into an HBO, I think, 10-part series. But I don't know what's going to happen with that now. The production shut down. Anyway, so that's
Emily
like it. That's
St. John Mandel.
There you go. No, look, good duck going on the fly. Anyway, I recommend it. It's really interesting, and that is a hinge event. You know, I don't know if this is yet, but we'll see. Anyway, read that book. It's a good one.
Yeah. You don't think it is? Or you're just not sure?
I'm not sure leaning to it's not.
Okay.
That's, yeah.
I guess, you know, it's a. I guess to me it's a question of timelines. Time. Right.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Will it prove to have been a hinge event in 5 years? Probably not. But, I mean, we're 20 years on from 9/11, and you can look at things that are happening today and trace them directly to that event. Whether they're policy things or, you know, so I think it takes a long time to probably know that for sure. So maybe I should not declare it so confidently.
Yeah, you know. Look, you think what you think.
It seems like a lot of change is going to come from this. One of those being people maybe not wanting to go back to offices.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
Yeah. What do you think?
Okay.
One more? Should we sneak it in?
Your call, boss. Let you go.
I'm looking through our questions and they all take big answers. So we're going to save them for next time.
Okay.
I mean, there's so much to do. Like
no,
climate.
Fair.
Oh, God. Yes.
Oh, my God.
No.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yes. No. This is just a preview.
Oh, my God.
Of what that's going to look like. So if you think this is rough, just you wait for the polarization that's going
to
come.
Stand by. All right. We are on the way out the door. A couple of things real quick. Back tomorrow with a regular, you know, news fix and a make me smile element. And then on Friday, I get to drink beer and Molly gets to drink whatever she wants. Also, we're going to do live on YouTube video. You can watch us live. We're going to have a link on the show page, makemesmart.org. I promise not to pick my nose. That's what I got.
I don't know if I can make that promise. I'm going to try to make that. That seems like a good promise to make. It's very exciting. Yes, live.
Yes.
Eventually, yeah.
Yes.
It's great. And then, of course, before we go, we just wanted to say thank you one more time. And if you are in a position to donate to keep this show going, we would love it. We've expanded at a time when Marketplace, and I'm sure you've heard everybody across media and everybody everywhere else are tightening belts hard. And so we are grateful for anything that you can do to support us. Marketplace.org/givesmart. Thank you.
Boom. Done. Oh, look at that. That's awesome.
I know.
That's awesome.
Beautiful.
In charge.
Beautiful.
Taking charge, carrying out the plan of the day.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. Ben Hethcote is our video producer, and Ethan Peretz is our video intern. And thank you to writer-producer Erica Phillips.
Daniel Ramirez drove today. Theme music was composed by Daniel and Ben Talladay. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
We were like Jimmy Butler with Daniel. We were like, oh, you're driving.
That's right.
I'll explain later, everyone. Find that on the Twitter. My brother has a new rule, which is to only send fun Twitter links, which, thank God, because, man, he finds a lot of weird stuff on Twitter.
Because there is.
He sent me a video of a guy the other day, like, on purpose, getting stung by one of those murder hornets.
What? No.
For science.
Come on,
like,
man.
For, like, science. What? I don't know. It was not okay. Not okay.
Hard pass.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.